Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome back to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. When you live outside of cities and closer to nature, you need to consider some things. What does my commute look like? How far away am I from healthcare? Will I be attacked by a cougar? Okay, that last one is unlikely, but one of the most important considerations, especially these days, is how to protect your home from wildfires. In 2018, the Washington legislature passed a law to create a set of codes for new homes in the fire-prone wildland-urban interface, or WUI. And we're going to be referencing the WUI a lot today, so remember, it's not just a sound that you make on a merry-go-round.
WUI!
It's the term for the places where nature and human development overlap. These codes would mandate the use of fire-resistant materials and regulate the types of vegetation around a home. But now, 6 years after the state set out on this task, the plan has been scrapped and the process is starting over. Much of the reason came down to a map.
The legislature directed the State Building Code Council to create codes, like I said, to protect homes from wildfire, essentially. And part of that was to have the Department of Natural Resources create a map of the wildland-urban interface in Washington. And within that map, areas that are considered in the interface would have to follow some of these codes.
Laurel Demkovich is a reporter at the Washington State Standard and has been following this story closely. She says that the proposed plan would have had big implications.
First of all, the map that was created by DNR, critics say it didn't necessarily take into account wildfire risk. So a lot of homes throughout the state were actually affected by these new codes. And critics said that it was going to be very expensive and kind of confusing to implement.
There was also widespread opposition to the defensible space codes, which limited the number of trees on someone's property in order to keep flammable stuff away from houses.
There was a lot of concern from environmentalists on that one that the state would just be going around and cutting down all of these trees across the state. But then there was also significant opposition from builders who said that implementing these new codes, especially in all these areas across the state that maybe weren't actually at risk of wildfire, would be very expensive and just cause housing prices to go up when the state's already in a housing crisis.
This year, the state legislature asked the Department of Natural Resources to redraw that WUI map. Then, on the day the codes were supposed to go into effect, the Building Code Council voted to toss them. So, 6 years of planning for wildfire resiliency now gone by with little to show for it. Laurel says that the last she heard from the Building Code Council, it will likely take 1 or 2 more years to complete a new map, and then the new codes can finally be implemented. Maybe. We'll see. This is all happening as states across the West are dealing with intensifying wildfires due to climate change. And Washington isn't the only state to attempt to regulate how and where homes are built in the wildland-urban interface. To better understand how Washington's struggle to create a WUI code fits with other states facing wildfire risk, I'm joined by Kimiko Barrett. She's the Wildfire Research and Policy Lead at Headwaters Economics. Hi, Kimmy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for allowing me, Libby.
So we're talking about Washington's difficulties with implementing a statewide building code for the wildland-urban interface. Have other states successfully implemented codes?
Absolutely. Certainly other states have done this to try and address home development in wildfire-prone areas. Washington by no means is alone. California is often held up as one of the leading states, setting an example. It's not a specific wildland-urban interface code or a WUI code in the same model that Washington has proposed, but it is the statewide building code, and it's known widely as Chapter 7A, and it does indeed regulate building construction materials, a bit on site design, layout, and it tries to really address the structural vulnerability of homes in high-risk areas. As has Nevada adopted a statewide WUI code, Montana similarly has done one as well. So again, Washington is not the first to do so, and it doesn't have to necessarily be at a state level. Cities can also adopt a WUI code, as has the city of Austin in Texas, for example, although the state of Texas itself has not adopted a WUI code.
In your researched opinion, What does a good set of policies here look like when it comes to building codes and homes in the wildland-urban interface?
So it's a complicated question, obviously, because we do know that risk varies by location, by site-specific characteristics. It depends if you have a neighbor, for example, or the terrain, the slope, how much wind you get. All of this drives wildfire risk to individual structures. But how a structure burns down and how that can lead to a potential urban conflagration or a wildfire disaster, as we have seen, is a similar pattern of destruction, unfortunately. And it's known within the wildfire science community as the disaster sequence. And so it simply means that once one home starts to burn, which is predominantly driven by embers, or if you can think of what comes out of a campfire, it's these little sparks of flame, these balls of flame that project themselves well ahead of a wildfire, anywhere from 1 to 4 miles advance of that wildfire. And if they land on any flammable surface area, then they can ignite the home, and then the home itself becomes a source of fuel. And the radiant heat from all of the interior flammable products burning at a very, very high intensity, like couches, furniture, appliances, again, all of them petroleum-based products. So when they start to burn and release their own heat, then the home is a threat to its neighbors. And then you get this structure-to-structure ignition across a community. And so what a WUI code is intended to do is really address that very first home from igniting or burning in the first place. Because we do know that voluntary measures, while really commendable in increasing education and awareness around wildfire risk, they themselves do not go far enough, and that it actually does require structure-to-structure mitigation measures across the board, because one home can be fully mitigated, but if his neighbor is not, then it's still a risk to the community, again, because of this radiant heat threat in addition to embers themselves.
And what are the successful strategies for combating those embers that can travel so far, as you mentioned? I mean, how do you defend your home against that?
It's a question of physics, Libby. So think about what a home is in the first place. It is a structure that's largely framed in wood. It has a lot of wooden product around it and in it. So the siding can be made of wood in some situations. The roof itself is made of wood as well. You may have a wooden deck. And then you place that very, very wooden flammable structure within a flammable landscape. The home is very, very vulnerable to ignition. So when we talk about reducing risk to a home, you're essentially talking about reducing the flammable surface area. And so it is things like taking down firewood off of your deck, for example, or relocating it. Think about where your propane tank may be for your barbecue. What is on your deck that might be highly, highly flammable, such as brooms or wicker furniture? And then you look up to your roof, what's on your roof line? Well, a lot of people, you know, might have pine needles accumulated within your gutters or within the roof valleys of the roof itself. And if you have a wooden roof, then that is also highly, highly flammable. So it's just thinking through in a very deliberate, intentional way about what is flammable on the home. And if this little ball of fire from an ember lands on it, is there potential for it to grow in size and intensity to become its own individual spot fire? So it's really talking about trying to reduce the flammability of the surface area and the little penetrations or the openings that can allow embers into the interior of the home, burning it from the inside out.
And again, you need widespread adoption, because if one home doesn't have that defensible materials or the inflammable materials, whatever it may be, that is supposed to be preventing these embers from catching, and the home next to it does, you still have that big fuel source in the flammable home. Kimmy, Washington isn't the only state that has stumbled in implementation of wildfire building codes. In Oregon, opponents successfully fought an effort to require fire-resistant materials in building. The Oregon Home Builders Association took issue with the costs associated with those codes. Basically, they were saying it's too expensive to build a fire-resistant home. How do you respond to that argument?
Yeah, this is also another great but complicated question. The costs of wildfire-resistant materials can vary by place, by supply, by demand, by contractor availability. That is true across the country again. But what we also see is that a lot of the materials for wildfire resistance are widely available and being used commonly in the market already. And the biggest examples out there are an asphalt composition roof. Many, many people already have asphalt shingled roofs. Again, they're widely available, they're durable, they're long lasting, and they are increasingly the most predominant roof covering in the country. It is also a Class A roof surface, meaning that it is already meeting wildfire resistant standards. Similarly, many, many homeowners already have dual pane tempered glass windows. This is for energy efficiency standards, but it also complies with wildfire resistance standards. So there are a lot of components of the home that already integrate wildfire risk ignition into how the home is constructed. It's just not commonly perceived to be meeting wildfire resistance standards. And one of the best examples I can think of in where this played out was the city of Austin, in that they recently did adopt a WUI code in 2020. And in talking through that and getting the ownership of the construction industry on board with this, the construction industry quickly realized that indeed, we actually are doing a lot of these efforts, but we're doing it for energy efficiency standards, or we're doing it for water retention or moisture considerations or snow, right? There's all these other aspects of hazard and weather mitigation that can be incorporated into wildfire resistant construction and therefore provide mutual benefits.
You've worked with the federal government on wildfire policy, and you sit on the Wildland Fire Mitigation and Management Commission, which is a collaboration between the USDA, Interior, and FEMA. Is there any movement from the federal government when it comes to reducing risks for homes in the wildland-urban interface? Any conversation about regulation or, further involvement to keep these homes safe?
There is, yes. And so the Federal Wildfire Commission has formally been dissolved by statute, but in the recommendations that we as a group, as a collaborative effort, came to 100% consensus on, were diverse. There's 148 recommendations in total, but the first 8 of them are explicit to what we are calling the built environment. And by the built environment, I'm talking about homes, neighborhoods, communities, and infrastructure. And it's the proactive investment in building homes better, retrofitting those homes that are already grandfathered into the existing housing stock, so that they are designed and constructed with wildfire in mind. And so we are encouraging in these recommendations to invest heavily in the built environment and in community risk reduction by establishing an interagency coordinating body that can be dedicated to risk mitigation, much as what we have already done for earthquake hazard reduction. And so when you think about hazards at large, it's only when people and homes are placed in harm's way that that hazard becomes a disaster. Similar is true for wildfire. It is a hazard that is a natural ecological process. And then when homes, when critical assets, when communities are placed in harm's way, then that hazard has very high likelihood to become a disaster. And so the recommendations are advocating for a more fundamental investment in community risk reduction that not only addresses the wildlands and forests and landscape treatments as we have historically done now for over 100 years, but now to equally invest in communities and the built environment so that we can equally address both the wildland and the urban when we talk about the wildland-urban interface.
Is there kind of a sense that, if we're not going to say, that certain homes shouldn't be built in certain areas, that the insurers that take on the risk of these certain, areas of the WUI will be sort of the hammer that will come down and say, these are simply too risky to insure. And then that will be sort of in the homeowner's lap to deal with.
So certainly the lack of insurance coverage or the retainment of coverage in high wildfire risk areas is a reality that many homeowners are facing. To say that insurance alone will drive the solution, however, I think is a bit of an overstatement, simply in that right now it is a shared risk and insurance is really reflecting what is already on the ground. So before insurance should really become part of that solution, we should be addressing this in a much more proactive way than we currently are. If homeowners can demonstrate that they have reduced risk across the neighborhood, including both the property and the structure themselves, then insurance providers are incentivized to retain coverage for that area. And this, again, addresses the vulnerability and the flammability of many of those homes in the first place. And this is what we are seeing evidenced piecemeal across the West in terms of a partnership and more of a collaborative effort with both private homeowners and the insurance providers. I think it's also fair to say, though, that not every homeowner comes at this with the same socioeconomic means, and that to mitigate a roof, for example, or to ensure a defensible space around the structure can be done fairly is going to require more investment at the federal level in the form of subsidies and tax incentives for homeowners, much as we have done with energy efficiency standards, grants and technical assistance provided to fire councils so that they can provide the expertise and the resources to homeowners who may not have the knowledge on how to mitigate their structure appropriately or may not have the financial means to do so. And so to simply say that every homeowner must meet these mitigation standards has to also consider some of those underlying socio and economic vulnerabilities that are certainly playing out in many places of the West.
So Washington State is going back to the drawing board on its wildland urban interface codes. They're going to take another stab at the rules and at the process of drawing a new map for where these codes will apply. Just let's set the stakes, as we leave here, Kimmy, last question. What are the stakes of not getting this done in a state like Washington?
At the most extreme, what can occur is that we're simply continuing to build unsafe, highly flammable neighborhoods and development in areas that we know have experienced and will continue to experience wildfires in the future. It should be noted that most of the areas that we live in and have settled here, particularly in the American West, are fire-adapted ecosystems, meaning that they are on a historical cycle of burning on a fairly regular occurrence. And they are adapted to fire, they are used to having fire. And through our very successful suppression efforts, we've contained that fire over the course of the past 100 years. So we actually have quite a bit of fuels now built up in those forests in the form of dead timber and branches and shrubs and all that vegetation within the forest themselves. But that's not the only problem. We have climate change driving exacerbated and more extreme wildfire behavior. And then as all of this is being driven, of course, also by increasing homes and communities and development in these same landscapes and areas that we know have experienced fire. And so it's a parallel rising trend across the board. And so unfortunately, the most extreme consequence is that we will see wildfire disasters occurring at a frequency and a scale that we have not seen in the past. We also know that wildfire response in the form of firefighters they will not be able to protect every home out there, and that this is an outdated expectation and an assumption that we need to change, that firefighters are not there to protect our homes as much as they are to ensure our safety, and that they are putting their lives at risk to save a home that was not built to withstand a fire in the first place. And then, as you noted, there's the insurance implications. So we could see a future where there's a widespread lack of insurance coverage. And this has many, many implications, not just in terms of economic and financial, but also of social and economic, about who necessarily can live in these high-risk areas. And that we can't address this by just treating the forest. If we're wanting to address the entire wildland urban interface, then we must very strategically and deliberately invest in the urban as much as we are in the wildland. And last thing I would note is that we have resolved this before with previous hazards, with earthquakes and seismic risk reduction. So we can do this again with wildfires. We just need to start thinking of communities adapted to a future of increasing wildfire.
And I mean, with earthquakes, we're talking about retrofitting, right? Like that's beyond even what the WUI codes in Washington State, at least, were suggesting. But it sounds like you think that is the future, is getting not just new homes or replacement homes up to code to be resistant to flame, but also retrofitting existing homes, which is another step that sounds necessary at this point.
Retrofitting is certainly a big part of the equation because they comprise so much of the existing housing stock in high-risk areas. And that is not traditionally addressed through WUI codes or building codes unless it's a significant remodel. So WUI codes, building codes, they do address only new proposed construction. That's very, very critical and is a big step in reducing risk to the community. And then retrofitting is certainly part of that as well. And that is, as you mentioned, not even part of what is being mentioned or proposed in Washington right now. I think that there is a future and a reality that we all must accept in that wildfire risks are increasing. They're getting bigger, they're lasting longer, they're burning hotter, and they're causing a lot more damage than ever before. Now is the time that we need to start investing and building our homes and communities with that reality in mind.
Kimiko Barrett is the Wildlife Research and Policy Lead at Headwaters Economics. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Libby.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.